This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. In conjunction with Malaysia Day tomorrow, I'm joined by two youth activists from East Malaysia to discuss how far Sabah and Sarawak have come since the formation of the Malaysian Federation in 1963 and what they are looking forward to next. My guests are Mahira Marzuki of Undi Sabah and Sun Weisen of Undi Sarawak. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, Dashran. Thank you for having us.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Glad to have you both on the show. Now, Mahira, there was a time, right, where Sabah and Sarawak were equal partners to Malaya in the Federation of Malaysia. That was the original agreement. We now know it as MA63. But over the years, that has eroded. But what's interesting is all of us, you guys were not born when Sabah and Sarawak were equal partners. When y'all were born in the 90s, I'm assuming 90s, that has already eroded to that ship of equal partners had already been sailed. How do you reflect on this? I'm learning through history of what, Sabah and Sarawak is supposed to be versus the Sabah and Sarawak that you grew up in.
Yeah, I guess like we've read history, but we didn't know how impactful it is, like the extent of how it manifests into, you know, our daily lives. So for me, it's just like when I was, in uni or when I was in high school, I learned that we were not treated as equal partners, especially when I go to like East Malaysia and notice how their progress is and the opportunities they were able to seize, not just in terms of infrastructure, like roads, schools, if schools are in good condition or like quality of education and opportunities in general. So I feel like in Sabah, you have to be like super privileged in order for you to achieve the best education. But like now we have to take a back seat. And like it all stems into like this bigger, issue. But now I'm more aware that it's bigger than that. It's about reinstating the dignity of Sabah and Sarawak. We agreed to be equal partners, and now we're only being treated as one of the states, and that status has been eroded. But obviously, it manifests into a lot of different things. But for me, that's my starting point.
And Sun, what about you? Because you too, you learned about the Sabah and Sarawak, Sarawak that was, through history textbooks, stories, things like that. How do you reflect on it and what made you care?
I think to clearly answer the question, I have to reflect back on our education system. Mm-hmm. I remember back then during Sejarah classes where we never or hardly ever talk about the eroded rights about the Borneo states.
Yeah.
And even the current hot topics of MA63, the Malaysian Agreement 1963. So I think back then, even I think currently also, there is little to none emphasis on such topics. And even if there were, it's just mere touch and go. So, I mean, from the context of, I grew up in Peninsula Malaysia. So there is a context of, or notions of, Sabah and Sarawak are very underdeveloped, uneducated and more. So, but until recently, when I studied in UNIMAS for 3 years back in my UC days, only have I seen and felt the full extent of the disparity between West Malaysia and East Malaysia. So I think the questions which I think Mahira might agree with me is, why, I think from the Sarawakan context, is why is the state of Sarawak, one of the major contributors of fossil fuel, still lagging behind with the other states in West Malaysia?
Yeah.
Why is Kuching, the capital of Sarawak, is not at par with cities like Subang Jaya in Selangor? Why isn't Sarawak and Sabah given full autonomy over their state in terms of, per se, healthcare, the construction of hospitals, autonomy over natural resources and more? And I think the most crucial question is, since we all shop on Shopee and Lazada the most, why is the postal service to Borneo states so much higher than that of the peninsula areas? So the exposure back then of knowing Sabah and Sarawak is just a normal Malaysian state to the country is just a mere dust across history.
Yeah.
Both Sabah and Sarawak should have been equal partners with Malaya in the formation of Malaysia. So having the equal rights, the equal benefits, equal autonomy and more. But I think over the years, I think I cannot justify this more, but I think with dirty politics playing a toll on this indoctrination, many have forgotten who they really are. even recently during the Muhyiddin administration, who promised reforms to the Borneo region, who made Sabah and Sarawak into the wilayah status, it does not make much any difference unless MSHG is put onto the parliament tables. So there are sentiments, I think, well, people might agree with me, is that people still make fun of Sabah and Sarawakians where they think people still live on trees. Yeah, I actually don't fathom such sentiments after studying Sarawak for several years and after all those years traveling to various communities in Sarawak and hearing the struggles, aspirations and wishes. I came to the notion of feeling the struggle I feel for the people in Sarawak. So, but in all those few, there is also beauty, there's also culture, there's also diversity, which not many people in, I would say, peninsula region knows of between Sabah and Sarawak. So there are riches here, which I think we should really exploit and we should really have people acknowledge it.
And Mahira, that's, you know, at the core of all this, right? The questions that Sun asked, you know, why do we have all these resources? But then we don't have the infrastructure and the development to go with it. Where is the revenue being lost? These are the questions that are constantly being asked, right? All of this ties to, you know, especially the growing talks about honoring the original document of MA63 and the autonomy of Sabah and Sarawak. And I think that's the key word, autonomy. Mahira, how important is autonomy to the people of Sabah and Sarawak and why is it important?
So I guess like it's important to honor us as equals first, and even in the first perkara, right, in the Malaysian Agreement 1963 on religion. So you can practice it freely as what stated in your MA63, and we don't see it being adhered to. And of course, to a certain extent, the local politicians are probably at fault here. Like the state constitution has been amended to declare Islam as a state religion, or the recent inclusion of a member of an Islamist party as an elected adun, even though no one elected him. Like, yes, we want autonomy, but I believe that Sabah and Sarawakian states, like, they have this external pressure, just like wanting them to change into like what federal would want them to be. And I believe that this stems from the change in status from equal partners to mere states, because if it's equal partners, we'd be, you know, autonomous. It seems small, but it is designed to increase power at a federal level, and it leads to even like economic problems, like what Sun said earlier, like federal government having control over the exploitation of natural resources in Sabah and Sarawak. And you were right in pointing out that Malaysia produces 60% of Malaysia's oil and gas, but only receive 5% of royalties, whilst the federal government keeps 95% of the revenue. And as a result, Sabah and Sarawak has limited resources to develop their own infrastructure, whilst the development in peninsula boomed. So I feel like many Sabahans and Sarawakians find difficulty in accessing basic needs when, in the first place, it's their revenue to, you know, for them to develop their own state. So I believe that the federal government kind of like pressure, like becomes an external pressure enforcing like things like official religion, diluting indigenous identity. I'm not sure for Sarawak, but like that's what I feel in Sabah, and reduce control over sovereign borders and land and water. So it's all those things, right? So when we are autonomous, I do believe that we can do more things for our people, but at the same time, it shouldn't be from the control of the federal. And I think our state politicians, like our local politicians, must also be aware of these things. But I'll talk more on this further later. But yeah, this is like my perspective, my point of view.
I think, you know, that one particular sentence you brought, you know, I'm not sure about Sarawak, but this is how it is here. And I think that's also very important to highlight, right? Because a lot of people in the peninsula, they also on, you know, they look at Sabah Sarawak as just one block. It's the same, but it's actually not the same, right? So Sun, Mahira brought up this idea of religion and how perhaps, you know, throughout the years, because of the lack of autonomy, the way federal in Malaya likes to, you know, their religious narratives and all of that, it's been slowly creeping into Sabah. What is it like in Sarawak? How important is religious freedom to Sarawakians? And have Sarawakians felt like that has been threatened perhaps in recent years?
No, I think in the topic of freedom of religion, I mean, no doubt it's a very important, it's a super important topic. Now, I think a vast majority of the Borneo states contain so much ethnicity, such as, I think I can say for the Sarawakan context, the Ibans, the Dayaks, the Dun Bawangs, the Kenyas, and more. All of it, which has different phases, different identities, different culture, diversity, and more. Now, I think this can be clearly justifiable by the news that we hear every day, is that Sarawakians do not like it if people politicize religion. I mean, it's common sense. Politicizing religion means you are disrespecting the local cultures and customs that have been there, I mean, since the ages of the cavemen. So whoever is a threat to such freedom of religion, you become a threat to their coexistence. It can also be cleared where even the local ethnic tribes are trying their best to preserve their culture and identity against, per se, modernization of Western cultures or modern cultures. So to add in another religious, per se, law that threatens them, this would definitely be a picker to them, as the local ethnic history can be eroded. I think a very good example is recently the party PAS wanted to stand in elections in Sarawak and bring forth some religious ideologies. And I remember back then the current state government, the GPS government, put their foot down and say, no, we do not want you to interfere with our culture and harmony here, because we know what PAS will bring to the table if they enter Sarawak. Harmony will be disrupted. So in doing so, this is where it's important, where we need to understand each other. We have to understand that many people in the Borneo regions per se are mostly Christians, while the rest spans to other religions. So I think it's the religion for, I think, Sabah, Sarawak, and maybe the Malayan states to maintain religious harmony, to be respectful of one another, to care for one another, and I think to also be inclusive of one another. Now, all this should not be done by force, but I mean, you know what am I saying? Religion should have never been the topic of politics in the first place. So, right. I mean, freedom of religion is really important. It is sensitive, no doubt. So, because it is sensitive, it is where we need to learn to be sensible, respectful, responsible, and mindful of other cultures. I think it is as simple as saying, we just want to coexist with you. Nothing more, nothing less. People in the urban might think differently, but then again, coexistence and respect is important for freedom of religion and harmony to exist.
Can I just add to that? I think, like, specifically in Sabah and Sarawak, because there's a lot of intermarriages, like, between races and ethnicities, so sometimes people practice religion reflective of their culture. And I think that diversity in culture, even within families, are super interesting. So when people, you know, like, ask you, like, yeah, hey, you can only subscribe to this one particular narrative, it's just, like, so bizarre for Sabahans and Sarawakians, because, like, we literally celebrate the diversity in culture, and sometimes it does mean like the religion that we practice also kind of seep into our culture. So it is interesting in that sense. But that's why, like, we, like what Soon said, we just want to coexist with one another. And we don't like it when, you know, like, certain people impose only one sort of narrative and want to overpower that harmony that is already existing in Sabah and Sarawak.
On the show with me today is Mahira Marzuki of Undi Sabah and Soon Wason of Undi Sarawak. After the break, I'll be asking them about youth political engagement in Sabah and Sarawak. Keep it here on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Mahira Marzuki of Undi Sabah and Soon Wason of Undi Sarawak. And we're talking about the East Malaysia that was, is, and can be. So, Mahira, there have been many issues because of the lack of autonomy. Some of it y'all highlighted earlier, you know, infrastructure issues, development issues, lack of revenue, royalties, and all of these things. But I think a lot of it really were exacerbated or brought to the forefront because of COVID-19. What are some of the issues that were really highlighted in such a perhaps visceral level in Sabah?
Yeah, I think definitely I agree what you said. The COVID pandemic highlighted this very much, like the structural problems that exist in Sabah. And people were able to see for the first time how unfortunate the reality is in Sabah, especially like I could say in Sarawak as well, like the main challenge is when it comes to education, infrastructure and health, like these three things are interrelated to the well-being of the people, right? So the main challenge is definitely people in rural areas, like even in urban areas, like people are already, suffering, but I do feel like it is like so much exacerbated in rural areas. And you have to take into consideration like Sabah's geography and how far everyone is from each other. So it's very difficult to have support structure. But in some areas, they don't even have proper roads for you to go to their community. You need a boat to travel to the villages, to the islands. Or most importantly, they need internet connectivity for students who want to, you know, study. Like imagine having a national exam like SBM and STPM. Like these things will dictate like your career for the rest of your life, and like it has taken a backseat because of how bad the situation is, and for them to access proper education is already extremely difficult. And things like healthcare, for instance, like if you have inadequate healthcare, and it's just poor management of healthcare as well, it becomes a much more it becomes worse, right? Like, so like your education is already taking a backseat, but also your health. So it made I would say first students are really taking a backseat. So it means the future generation of Sabah will be severely impacted. So it's extremely worrying, but also like even all Sabahans, I think we're impacted by this. So like the contexts are very different in Sabah and Sarawak, but also like I can speak for Sabah, especially people in rural areas. But I don't know, like what do you think, Soon?
I think I can say the same as you in terms of education. I mean, especially in the cases of exams. I remember the case of Viviana,
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She has to go the extra mile in order to get proper internet.
And Soon, that's what I wanted to ask you, right? Because, you know, we hear about, Viviona having to climb a tree just to get her homework done, people needing to climb hills to, you know, get internet connection just so they can do online classes. Is this what happens in Sarawak as well? Are the issues in Sarawak that were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic similar to Sabah?
I think I would say the same. I think there are, if you were to put examples, I can put examples of, per se, teachers going the extra mile to give children homework. I think if I recall this case study, is that I believe it is a teacher from SK Long Sukang by the name of, I think, Muhammad Nazmi Rosli, and his fellow teacher colleagues. They were delivering homework to their students in, I think, 13 villages in Lawas, Sarawak. So I think not only has the COVID-19 pandemic affected students to the extent of internet connectivity, but it's also a double whammy for teachers to the extent that they have a duty to perform for their students in order to give them proper education. So I think that's also one of the extra things that happened amidst all this. But now I think education is a rooted word in the Borneo states. We have seen problems of rural areas not getting quality education for the students and also facilities. So this is where I want to emphasize on the playing field. I mean, apart from COVID, the playing field, if we were to compare the rural and urban divide, is greatly there's a great disparity. I mean, it isn't leveled properly and people are not getting the proper or equal education as per their urban counterparts, as what Mahira mentioned. People have to go the extra mile in order to go to schools. It can be going through boats, walking a huge distance to schools. So, I mean, even this is an old issue, but I think it should be highlighted now that people are still experiencing this. And why isn't people highlighting this? Why isn't people talking about the importance of infrastructure and roads in Sarawak? We have the famous Pan Borneo Highway, which I think is completed, but there's still so much maintenance that needs to be done in order for the roads to be fully accessible and fully safe for travelers to use it. So I think in the context of infrastructure, I can also say the same for the healthcare system in Sarawak. I think I remember watching the film from Freedom Film Network, The Story of Kamogong, where it mentioned about the vast disparity between the healthcare system in Sarawak and the peninsula states, where I think one doctor in Sarawak served 3,000 patients, while one doctor in peninsula served 1,400 patients. So if you look at these statistics, there's a huge disparity between such. And I remember from watching the film, the story of Kamugong, where a pregnant mother had to walk miles and miles to roads in order to get to the nearest hospital. And even the simplest of getting proper medication, especially in the case of this pregnant mother, to get a gynae to assist her was so hard. And all they told her was to, you know, if something simple, mothers of age experience such things, just go home. So the fact that doctors who are supposed to lead to save lives say such things brings so much volume to the healthcare system in Sarawak. I mean, I cannot say much of what's going on with COVID. I think Sarawak is doing quite well for it, but in the other side of the door, we also lack the expertise, the facilities, the standards, and most importantly, the manpower to spearhead the healthcare in terms of being higher and being of a stronger standard. So though the COVID-19 has exposed so much severity in the healthcare, the so little hospitals that we have are still hanging on the balance. So yes, it has ravaged Sarawak, COVID-19, but it has also exposed many weaknesses in the place, and something should be done. And not to also mention about the word brain drain. We talk about infrastructure, but there's also the problem of manpower, if I can put it right.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, for example, Sarawak has many talents, no doubt. I think Sabah also has so much talent, no doubt. So
yeah.
Talents are more drawn to city of opportunities, such as KL. So what happens, again, we talk about infrastructure. So what happens when there aren't any or little opportunities in the Borneo states itself? What happens if there's not enough infrastructure for these talents to exploit? So, I mean, it's also human nature.
Mm-hmm.
People will tend to migrate, and this will leave a huge loophole in the Borneo states, especially when infrastructure is still lagging behind. So I think it's a collateral effect where one thing gets hurt, it hurts another. Like if infrastructure is lacking, so what do? You migrate to a bigger city with bigger opportunities. So that's one of my 2 cents about the infrastructure collateral effects in the Borneo states.
I feel like it's super unfortunate that even like some people actually has died to access certain opportunities. And like, for instance, students wanting to access internet. I think in Sarawak, if I'm not mistaken, you know, students wanting to get internet connection and they end up like they fell into the river. And I think that is just like extremely disheartening, and something needs to be done because it's not an isolated case. And, you know, politicians need, or the federal government, state government, local politicians need to extremely be proactive.
Now, when we talk about, you know, all these issues, people always look to the next generation, you know, our generation, our future generations, people who are in high school right now and all that. What are we going to do about it next? So in this context, both of y'all are youth activists in Sabah and Sarawak. Y'all push for political advocacy, political engagement among the youths and all of that. Mahira, what's the youth political engagement like now in Sabah?
Well, it depends. I think it's just like football. You tend to root the team your family's been supporting.
Mm-hmm.
But in Sabah, I feel like the trend is they tend to support around a personality. But even if they were to support certain parties, they may want to push for reforms for those specific parties. I just want to preface that it's definitely easier to mobilize in our generation. Because we are extremely connected. But especially in East Malaysia, right, I think the main challenge on top of like maybe like everyone has like specific preference to their parties, but I think like more information needs to be cascaded down to society. And especially in East Malaysia, the main challenge is reaching rural areas, and you have to take into consideration of Sabah's geography and how far everyone is from each other, because in some areas they don't have proper roads for you to go to their community. You need a boat, for instance. So they need internet connectivity for them to receive messages of advocacy. So it's currently extremely difficult. And this is obviously amplified because of COVID that we spoke about earlier. So you require a lot of resources for you to reach these communities. And it's a huge hindrance, especially for youth activists, because they're mostly students or they're just starting their career and they're only doing this in your individual capacity. So it's just or just like generally marginalized communities wouldn't have access to this information. But it's not just that. I think like youth activists, even like in urban areas, who have better connection to everything and everyone else, I think it could also be how well will they be able to filter information, because it could also be influx of information and there's going to be a lot of misinformation. I think that is one of the struggles that we face now. And the challenge is whether they're able to reach the correct source of information, aka have they made their check and balances when it comes to worldview, different perspectives, different news portals, and is it backed by data? And that's why advocacy matters, and we need to make that information as succinct and easily understandable for people who's only starting to learn, especially those who are only starting to learn about certain issues and who don't know anything about, you know, certain issues that may impact their community.
I think Mahira has covered really good about the urban rural divide and how the rural areas are experiencing such disparity, but I think for us in Undi Sarawak, I think our main goal, I mean, as you said, we're trying our best to penetrate through the rural areas. As you also mentioned, that the amount of apex of youth there, they are not really informed of all these situations or such. But I think it is also very hard to say this, but if I were to give a personal experience, I believe all of us here in Sarawak, I mean, the truth hurts, but we are still in our own bubble. So it's in a layman's term, we haven't broken our shell yet. But to really penetrate this such, I think we have to change strategies, change the way we do things. Because I think in terms of Undi Sarawak, our main audience is mostly the urban youth. But I think with programs by Undi 18 especially, we have seen programs such as the Dewan Muda Malaysia, Fellow Parliament, Undi Negaraku now, and then other events. I believe with such programs, people representing these programs in their own constituencies can bring the message to the rural areas. It is as simple as using the strongest marketing material in the world, which is the word of mouth. So even from the point of view of Undi Sarawak, we were established last year in August, and gradually as the months goes by, we have seen a gradual increase in Sarawakan youth being concerned. But again, the question still looms. We are only getting urban audiences. What about the rural audiences? So I think I would channel inspiration from one of the NGOs in Sarawak, where they took a roadshow throughout Sarawak in order to provide a space for youth to be politically and socially engaged in events, in current affairs. So I think with such events, we can really penetrate the rural areas. But whether political or social, it intertwines, especially to those who are attending like the Dewan Muda program or even Parliament Digital program. Them being a youth representative for their own constituency, I mean, personally for me also, has brought so much inspiration for other youth that even the other youth wants to be part of it. So I think I'll use the word collateral effect. If one is interested, the rest will be interested. So again, as the saying goes, most youth do not want to be left behind. And I think I can say the same for the rural areas. Though they are still lagging behind, but I believe also that they do not want to be left behind in all those progress that youth are actually progressing now. So and if youths were more aware, they will come to an eventuality how vital their participation is, because, you know, kita dah generasi baru. I believe we are, especially for Sarawak, I have to say the hard truth. We are slowly rising to our epicenter. Yes, people say it's slow, but I think the term goes, if change takes time, then we should take our time. I think it's all about being human. So I think, yes, the rural areas are one big playing field which we haven't conquered yet, but if it takes time, we will take our time. Because again, we cannot do everything so drastic that in the end, we lose the essence of the message. So I think youth participation is important to some extent, but it has to be taken step by step. And I think another point to also point out is education also, which is very important to all of us youth. I think Mahira will also agree that we were only exposed to general studies during Form 6 or A-levels, like mm-hmm. I think in the subjects of pengajian or general studies. I think personally that is rather too late, where where else it should have been done way earlier than maybe perhaps Form 1. With early exposure to, per se, these topics, maybe basics of politics or social science, that way, youth participation in all this politics or social work, if I can bet, I will bet, it will increase. Because it will make youth become, I think, two important factors. It will make youth informed and concerned. Informed to know what is going on in our country. Concerned to know that they also care for the future of our country. I mean, we have seen, like, ever since Parliament Digital has arisen, many people are caring of what is going on in our country. So this is what we are seeing in today's youth, where many are informed and many are concerned. But again, the playing field is the urban area. We still got the rural areas to talk about. So yeah.
All right, guys. Now, as we wrap this conversation up, we've talked a lot about problems. We've talked about youth political engagement. But before we finish this off, you know, we are doing this in light of Malaysia Day that's happening tomorrow. What do y'all wish to see from Sabah and Sarawak, respectively? If y'all had a magic button and, you know, we pushed that button and we could, you know, make your dreams come true to reshape the landscape of Sabah and Sarawak, what will y'all love to see? What is your wish list? Mahira, let's start with you.
First, I think definitely more infrastructure, improvement of infrastructure in Sabah, but of course done in sustainable ways. But secondly, I would want youth to be able to learn about more issues, especially people in urban areas. And like what Soon said, I wish also Undi Sabah would be able to penetrate these communities. But secondly, I wish the federal government would honor the Malaysian agreement, MA63 agreement. I think it would put us back to what we intend to be in the first place. I wish politicians in Sabah and Sarawak can set their own terms rather than always coming into compromise with federal government. But lastly, I wish Sabahans can be less xenophobic, maybe to stateless communities in Sabah, because they, you know, we have a lot of them, but I feel like there are trends of us kind of like alienating them rather than helping them and assisting them. I just wish like all of us in Sabah are able to understand and empathize with struggles of, you know, different communities. I think once we do that, we're able to move forward and we're able to also stand on our own to ask for what we deserve. Happy Malaysia Day, guys.
Soon, what about you?
I think Mahira covered everything already, but I think the one thing which I really want to point out is I think the government should stop playing politics and put MA63 to the table already. I mean, I think currently our constitution, if I'm not wrong, Mahira, we are pursuant to the Malayan Agreement 1957. And I think it's time where us three as equal partners, where the MA63 papers should be put on table. And I forgot the articles, but I think one of the articles should be pursuant to the Malaysian Agreement 1963. And to also add on to Mahira, I mean, yes, happy Malaysia Day, but I think to really rejoice and to really be unified, I think 16 September should be the true holiday of Malaysia for all three states.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. Each partner will have their own independence, like Malaysia and Sabah is 31st August and Sarawak is the 22nd of July. But to really celebrate what is meant to be 31st August this year, 16 September should be the true holiday of reuniting Malaysia together. And I think I'll add another one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is a very layman. I think from the Sarawakan context also, I think Borneo also, we wish that people in Semenanjung will care more about Sabah and Sarawak issues. Because sometimes the Borneo states are always locus-side. I think Mahira can agree with me that we're always locus-side, especially like during the vaccination rate in Sarawak. Like people be asking, why is Sarawak getting all this vaccination? Why? Is it because of state elections? I think it's like what Mahira mentioned. I mean, the roads in Sarawak is so difficult for medical officers to penetrate, even the villagers to penetrate. So people need to understand and things start to care about Sabah and Sarawak more about our issues, to learn about our cultures. Just, yeah. I think it's what I said, it's not to really coexist, we need to know one another.
On that wonderful note, thank you so much for joining me today, guys. Happy Malaysia Day.
Thank you, Dashan.
Thank you, Dashan. Happy Malaysia Day.
That was Mahira Marzuki of Undi Sabah and Sun Wei Sen of Undi Sarawak. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my. We're also available on Spotify, Apple, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.